Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Leanne McNamara, a medical doctor and lecturer in classics at La Trobe University. This is episode LXIX, Galen and the Antonine Plague. As the Parthian War comes to an end, the troops are dispersed throughout the Roman Empire, and with them goes the Antonine Plague. The effects of the plague will be felt for decades to come, and we know much about it through the extensive writings of the physician Galen. Here's Leanne McNamara.
If I was in the ancient world, what would I think of a plague? I get the impression it's just a kind of a, oh look, another plague has hit us.
Yes, a plague is a catch-all phrase, I guess, for any epidemic disease outbreak. And they were absolutely a fact of life in the Roman world.
Were they frequent? Were they life-altering?
Absolutely, they were frequent. So pandemics on the scale of the Antonine Plague were perhaps less common, but localised outbreaks were very common. We absolutely see that referred to in much of the literature. Livy is a good source for us for the Roman Republic. He refers to a plague or a disease outbreak in the early books, perhaps before around 290s. There's an outbreak about every 8 years. And then after 290 to about, let's say, 165, the average is about every 5 years there's a disease outbreak.
And was it the same disease rolling around more or less? Or
almost certainly not the same disease. Yeah. It must have been outbreaks of different sorts of diseases. But they are not interested in putting a diagnostic label on the outbreak in the same way that we are today.
Yeah, sure. So sometimes it's a bit hard to determine what disease they're suffering from, maybe.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're obsessed with trying to give a name to a disease outbreak, and it's not something that's of concern at all to the ancients themselves.
So how was the disease spreading then? I can see two kind of explanations here. One is that it would move with the people, so people migrating, the army moving from one area to another, those kind of activities, but also with the growing trade network.
Absolutely. I think both of those things account for disease outbreaks becoming more frequent and more severe as populations come into contact with diseases they haven't seen before and thus have no background immunity to. We see in Livy the number of plague outbreaks increasing over time, and the severity of the outbreaks seems to increase, particularly as we get into the imperial period. Big disease outbreaks, for example, under Nero.
Yeah.
There's a plague in 65 CE that wipes out perhaps 30,000 people, according to Dio. They become big events.
The Romans are well known for their hygiene habits. Was that a blessing during the time of plague, or was it something that would roll on despite their hygiene?
I don't think their public sanitation would have helped at all.
Really?
With most outbreaks that tend to not be waterborne. Their sanitation really revolves around aqueducts, so bringing in fresh water, and perhaps the toilets, taking away waste product that way. This would not help prevent diseases that are spread by personal contact or airborne diseases. In fact, there's some evidence that parasites have increased in areas where the Romans have moved in and put toilets in. Toilets were often communal affairs and places where people would sit and have a chat together.
Yeah.
And in fact, may have led to increasing outbreaks of disease rather than decreased.
So why is it that the Antonine Plague in particular sticks out as an event in ancient Rome? Is it just the scale of it then?
I think the scale of it has a lot to do with it. I think another very important factor is that Galen, a very influential figure in the history of medicine, was around at the time and wrote about it. So it's recorded in a number of sources, not just Galen, but I think it's fascinated historians afterwards because of Galen's surviving writings.
To the extent that it's sometimes known as the Galen Plague, isn't it?
Yes, it is, absolutely. Yeah.
So what was the Antonine Plague and how did it reach and spread through the Roman world?
So the Antonine Plague is a disease outbreak that probably began in 165 CE. It was spread from Mesopotamia in the Parthian Wars and spread right through really the Roman Empire to Spain, Gaul, probably even across to Britain and Wales. It went from 165 to at least 172 CE, probably much later into the 180s.
Yeah.
There is another disease outbreak that's described in 189 CE, which may well be a recurrence of the same disease outbreak. So it's a very long lasting and very wide reaching disease outbreak.
And how significant was it? How many people are we talking about being affected? Vaguely, I know it's hard to know.
This is absolutely a bone of contention in the scholarship, how many people were affected. Estimates range from between 50% mortality, which is going to be absolutely too high in my opinion, down to maybe 1% of the population. Probably the most realistic estimates are around 7 to 10% of the population died at this time. So we're talking around 5 million people. So a very significant disease outbreak.
Did everybody who caught it die?
No. Yeah. We have a number of accounts of people who've survived the plague. So we really don't know what the mortality might have been. We might put a guess at 80%, but that might be too high. It really depends on what the disease was.
So where did it come from? You said it came across during the Parthian Wars. Do we know anything more with that?
We have the source of the Historia Augusta that tells us in the life of Lucius Verus that the plague began in Babylonia. Apparently, when the soldiers disturbed a golden casket in the Temple of Apollo, the plague arose from this golden casket being disturbed in this temple.
So like an act of God kind of thing.
Absolutely. There's a very similar story in Marcellinus, a soldier and historian who's writing much later in the 4th century. But he also says that a statue of Apollo was stolen by the generals of Verus. And they found a crevice in the temple while they were sacking it. And again, this pestilence has arisen. So amongst these non-medical or lay writers, it's absolutely seen as an act of God, in particular an act of Apollo.
Is this a common attribution for plagues back in those days? They saw them as punishment?
It does seem to be, certainly amongst the, as I say, lay or non-medical writers.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely. The doctors or medical writers, on the other hand, are very keen to distance themselves from that sort of supernatural or religious type of explanation and are looking for a much more rationalistic or scientific type explanation.
If there's that kind of thinking, then what did ancient medical writers or doctors attribute these kind of things to? What was their knowledge of how a plague spreads or where it comes from?
It was quite difficult for them to explain with their understanding of how the human body and how disease worked. There were a number of competing medical theories, but perhaps we're most familiar with the theories of Galen. He understood the body as consisting of humours or fluids within the body, and disease is caused when those internal fluids, they are blood, black bile, yellow bile and phlegm, when those humours get out of balance within the individual.
Right.
So this sort of explanation doesn't lend itself well at all to an idea of contagion or a disease that is external, spreading between people. So Galen comes close to an idea of contagion, perhaps in attempting to explain the Great Plague, when he says that when there is plague and where there is plague, there are putrid exhalations in the air, he calls it. And when people who have a predisposition in their body inhale these putrid exhalations in the air, the dangerous residues that they have inside them are somehow activated and putrefied themselves, and they then are susceptible to the plague.
So he's almost on the right track for an airborne virus.
He really is. He's getting on the track. He hasn't got a germ theory yet, but it's a way of explaining contagious diseases.
Well done to him for figuring that much out back then, at least. So who was Galen then?
Galen was a Greek-speaking physician who was born in what's modern-day Turkey in Pergamum in 129 CE, and he is a very influential figure in the history of medicine. He was trained in philosophy. But after his father had a prophetic dream in which the healing god Asclepius visited him, telling him Galen should become a doctor, he had his son educated in medicine.
Yeah.
Galen then travelled widely. learnt both philosophy and practical medical skills. He became a surgeon, if you like, or at least a physician to the gladiators in his hometown of Pergamum, where he must have picked up quite a lot of skills. He then travelled to Rome through his self-promotion, really, became well-known, and in fact he became the physician to the emperors. So he was the physician for Marcus Aurelius. He looked after Commodus, perhaps not everyone so happy that he looked after Commodus well, and probably also Septimus Severus.
It seems that doctors were quite important people back then, going by him at least.
If we were to take Galen, yes, we would think that doctors were very important, but Galen is the exception.
Right.
Generally speaking, doctors are not elite people. Galen does come from an elite family and, as I say, is very much big on self-promotion and managed to move in the upper echelons of society. But most doctors were not in those upper echelons at all.
All right. So where did his interaction come with for the Antonine Plague?
He was in Rome when the disease first broke out. And in fact, he left Rome in 166, perhaps because of the plague. Mm. It's very unclear why he left. He gives two explanations in different pieces of writing. In the first piece of writing, he says that it was his enemies that caused him to leave Rome. But perhaps 30 years or so later, when he's writing again about this period of time, he attributes the plague to his flight from Rome. So he witnessed it there in 166. He was then invited, because he is such an excellent doctor and philosopher, as he puts it, by the emperors, Lucius Verus and Marcus Aurelius, to attend them on campaign in 168. And when he arrived at their winter quarters in North Italy, the plague broke out. The emperors soon decamped from that winter camp back to Rome, but Galen was left there at least until spring of 169.
Right, so he's getting first-hand exposure is probably not what you want when it comes to a plague, but he's getting first-hand experience when it comes to dealing with the plague and what the plague is doing to the people there, isn't he?
Yes, he is. So he doesn't give us a solid description of the plague in any one place, but we find lots of references to the plague scattered throughout his writings. And we do get one case history in particular where he describes how the plague affects a young man that he's treating.
Can you take me through that a little bit?
So it's a text called The Method of Medicine. He describes treating a young man who had broken out in sores all over his whole body on the ninth day that he was suffering from the plague. And it's actually the ulcers or the skin rash that Galen's most interested in describing here. In particular, he talks about the cough that this young man develops, which causes him to bring up scabs when he's coughing.
Yeah.
So that must have been very unpleasant. He's quite keen to locate those scabs as coming from the trachea. They're definitely not from the pharynx, he says. They're coming from the larynx and the windpipe, the trachea. He describes the rash that lots of the sufferers of the plague have. He says that the rash often has a remnant in it, like ash, which nature forced out of the skin, he says. Some kind of perhaps dried blood coming out of these scabs. In some of them, there's ulceration and the surface falls off in scabs. But in others, there's no ulceration. The skin is simply rough and itchy and falls off like scales. So that all sounds very unpleasant. He also tells us that these sufferers of the plague have high temperatures. They feel like they are suffering from burning.
Mm.
They can vomit. He describes the diarrhea that they suffer in great detail, beginning out yellow, becoming redder, and finally becoming black, which we would now call melena. We'd see that as dried blood in the stools. So a quite devastating sign, in fact.
Yeah, yeah. This seems to be really extensive. Can we tell from this what the Antonine Plague must be? Because there clearly must be discussion about trying to diagnose it based on his notes.
There is a lot of discussion, and most of the discussion centres around his description of the appearance of the skin. It's perhaps most likely to be smallpox, in particular hemorrhagic smallpox. However, there's no certainty about this, and there have been many other explanations. This could be perhaps typhus. It has been suggested even that it's the bubonic plague, though I think that is very unlikely given the description that Galen gives us. It may, of course, be another disease entirely that we're unaware of.
That's died out since. Yeah.
And measles or even mumps have been suggested. I think mumps is very unlikely. Mm. Measles is a possibility.
But likely smallpox?
Most likely smallpox.
Okay. And it wasn't just about diagnosing in that time or describing the symptoms. It was also, to some extent, about treating it. So what did Galen try and do to treat the Antonine Plague?
Galen doesn't tell us in great detail exactly what he did. With this particular case study of the young man, he tells us that he treated the sores with a drying medication and that he gave him a moistening medication to hold in his mouth that would trickle down into the trachea. The young man took it upon himself to drink milk, and Galen is very happy with this decision. He gives a long excursus on the benefits of milk. So it seems that he may well have used milk himself in treating these patients. He also tells us that people who were purged, that is, who vomited, got better. It's not clear whether he is suggesting that one should induce vomiting in these people as a treatment, or whether he's simply observing that those people who vomit do survive.
So was there any effective way that they could deal with this sort of plague back then? Because it doesn't sound like there's a lot of solutions other than just waiting and seeing if you die.
Well, Galen was quite confident in his own abilities. As a modern doctor looking back, I have to say that I'm not sure that the milk and the ointment would have been effective. Nonetheless, Galen seems to have been confident. Mm. We have an interesting account by another orator who was struck down by the plague and survived. Aristides is his name. He tells us that he was visited in a dream by Asclepius, the healing deity. And Asclepius, after he has visited in the dream, reveals to him that he should take some certain medications, which he then follows. These include an enema of honey. That doesn't sound very pleasant, but he does this. Then some drugs. Unfortunately, he doesn't tell us which drugs. Then foodstuffs. So he starts out with a goose liver pate and moves on to sausages.
Yeah.
And luckily, Aristides is cured. Again, I couldn't say that it was the effects of the enema and the food, but he clearly believes that it is.
Yeah. But again, it's a divine intervention, not only causing the plague, but curing it there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Aristides is not the only one to resort to the gods. We also have some references to an oracle that people would write upon their doors to ward the plague off. We're told this by Lucian, who in fact is quite dismissive of this treatment. He says that in fact the people who wrote this oracle asking Apollo to spare them in fact were struck down by plague more often than those who did not put the oracle above their doors. Nevertheless, the fact this story exists would indicate that people are turning to the gods, in this instance Apollo, to get some relief from the disease.
Yeah. If we could go back to Galen for a moment, he becomes quite famous after his time. He's quite a prolific author, and he has quite a contribution that lasts for a long time to medicine, doesn't he?
He is the most prolific author of all, I think. About 10% of all ancient Greek literature, right back from 750 BCE into the 4th century CE, 10% of that entire corpus is Galen. That is a massive contribution. Over 400 books are attributed to Galen. At least 350 of these are genuine texts that Galen wrote. It's been calculated that he must have been writing around 3 pages a day, every day of his working life, 50 to 70 years.
Mm, not that we have all of that, though.
We don't have all of it, unfortunately. Much of it was lost, in fact, in Galen's own lifetime. The Temple of Peace, in which he stored his writings, burnt down in, I think it was 191 CE. So he lost much of his output then. and through the vagaries of time since, we have lost a lot more. Nevertheless, his writings were important in both the Western world, but also in the Arab-speaking world. So in fact, we have lost some of the Greek texts that Galen himself wrote, but we have Syriac or Arabic or even Hebrew translations. And in some instances, we have Latin translations of his works that have survived for us. We still have around 20,000 pages of Galen surviving to us. It's an awful lot for any one person to be across.
So what about his knowledge? What ideas did he have that were significant at the time and I suppose were carried along in later knowledge for a while?
Oh my goodness, he's significant in a number of fields. He wrote not only on medical topics, he certainly wrote extensively on philosophy. We know he wrote extensively on Aristotle, and most of that has been lost now, unfortunately. He wrote on linguistics as well, on poetry, but of course it's his medical works that are best known today. He wrote on anatomy, and anatomy is one of the key things that we think of with Galen.
He had to do anatomical work on animals, didn't he? He couldn't do it on humans.
Yes. At the time that he was practicing, there was an edict forbidding dissection of human beings. So he dissected animals. He was very keen on dissection. He believed that one should practice dissection every day. He also very much used dissection as a tool of self-promotion. He would dissect in public to wow the crowd.
Like a performance piece.
Absolutely, like a performance piece.
Wow, yeah.
He's particularly well known for dissecting, unfortunately, perhaps vivisecting is the right word here, a living pig. He was able to ligate the nerves to the larynx, the voice box of the pig, and stop the squealing, and then remove the ligatures on the nerves and have the pig squeal again. And this was a performance piece that he would do.
How about knowledge and theories? How much of an impact did he have on modern medicine?
His theories absolutely became the basis for learned medicine in Europe and in the Islamic Arab-speaking world as well. His textbooks were the basis for academic medicine, and his ideas really persist right into the 1900s, if we're honest. They were gradually becoming debunked from the reintroduction of human dissection with Vesalius in the 1500s, but still many aspects of Galenic medicine continued to permeate into the 1900s.
So how does the ancient world get rid of a plague? Is it just something that dies out naturally? It runs its course?
It would seem that that would be the case, that Rome does not institute any particular measures that eliminate the plague. It does frequently flare up from time to time and in different places. So I mentioned that there is another disease outbreak in 189 CE, which may be a flare up of the Antonine Plague. But really, it does just have to run its course.
That's Dr. Leanne McNamara, a medical doctor and classics lecturer at La Trobe University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in iTunes. Please leave a review there. Reviews are always appreciated. We're just a little podcast and we love to be loved. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook and you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at NightlightGuy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, one good war deserves another, and this one will keep Marcus Aurelius busy for the rest of his life. But until then, I am Matt Smith and you have been fantastic. Thanks for listening.